Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, social critic, and mentor. Navigating the messy art of living and the complex beauty of relationships through these conversations that we need to have but often shy away from, it's time for a conversation with the reluctant therapist, and it's another Tuesday, Elizabeth, and nice to see you. Where are we heading off to today?
Well, today I have one of my best friends here in the studio with me, so I'm very, very excited to share her with everyone.
Nice.
But I want to start by saying this. You know, throughout our life, I think there's a pressure from the time we're young to find that thing that we're good at. It came up in class yesterday in my counseling profession class, and all the students are so concerned, like, what is my passion and what will I do and how will I make my living and what is my meaning? And we put so much emphasis on having those answers at such a young age. And yet, more often than not, when I talk to people who have, you know, achieved things in their life or gotten to, you know, a place where they feel proud of their accomplishments, and I'll say, you know, did you always want to do this? More often than not, they'll say, oh, I had no idea, or I would have never thought of this when I was young, or this is not something that I considered. I mean, I think of my trajectory to where I am today, and if someone said you're going to be a professor at Cal Poly when you're 50, I would have laughed so hard because my sixth grade teacher told my parents, if Elizabeth can't find a job that pays her to talk, I am really frightened for her future. I found the one thing that I could do, but I would have never imagined it when I was young because I was never considered a good student or an academic. And so I'm excited to share my friend who has had a lifetime of really interesting hats that she's worn that have been aligned in one direction, but also very varied. And I can't wait for her to talk about whether or not this is something she dreamed of when she was young. I love this a little bit because I feel like I'm on the dating game and I'm not telling you her name and you're having to kind of guess who it might be, because she is a local celebrity. My best friend is. And so many people have come across her because she spent years being an environmental activist and great supporter of the county and very involved in local politics as well. But I want this conversation to be, I want this conversation to be one of, oh, and look where you ended up, and not like, oh, you planned this when you were 18 or first walked onto a college campus. I wish my students could really understand that they will find their passion when they're 80, because you'll look back and say, oh, look at all of the things I did. Those were all of my interests along the way, instead of feeling this almost frozen sense of, if I can't figure out what I'm good at by the time I graduate, I've already failed at life. And people will say, oh, no, everyone gets it. Everyone understands that you're not going to know what you want right off the bat. Like, we say those things, but that's not the message that these young people are living every single day. They truly believe every single day that every grade they get in the 4 years they're at college will make or break their entire future. And I find that heartbreaking because there's so many things that they could be discovering if they just set aside this idea that they had to be on a path to somewhere instead of be in a place of absorption. Like, our 20s should be about absorbing the world. What are all of the options that I have out there? Who are all the people that I might get to know? What are all of the things that I might be good at that I have absolutely no idea I might be good at? It's not laying around playing video games, right? Netflix and chilling. I'm not saying that. I'm saying living with force and vigor and thriving and, you know, kind of piecemealing jobs together and living with a bunch of roommates, kind of keeping yourself afloat, but experiencing life. And then you get married and you have some kids, and around 30 or 40 or 50, you might look back and go, oh, I've done some cool things. Wow, go me. That feels like a much more organic path. And having said that, there are people I know who knew they wanted to be doctors when they were 5 years old. I can tell you that, you know, all the boys that we hung out and played doctor down at the creek with when I was a kid, two of them became doctors. So there you go.
Nice.
Some people know. So anyway, that's kind of the setup for today's conversation. My guest is Kara Woodruff, and she has been a part of the San Luis Obispo community for over 30 years, having raised both of her daughters, which is how we originally met, because our daughters grew up doing theater and Destination Imagination together. So Kara and I have traveled the state and traveled the country supporting our daughters, and it just gave us this phenomenal foundation, this bond that we've carried as friends now for over 20 years. And I know, it's gone fast, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So admire Kara for her life and the things that she's accomplished, but also she has a lot of insights about what's going on in San Luis Obispo, because she's currently the district director for California State Senator John Laird. And so I get to spend time and we get to learn what's going on in the state of California, and also in Kara's role as a longtime member of the Diablo Canyon decommissioning engagement panel. I don't know if you know what's going on there, but I'm a little out of the loop as to what's happening. And then most recently, Kara became a member of the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary Advisory Council, which I also know is super exciting. Didn't know she was a part of, but I want to find out what they're doing as well. So I'm going to stop right now and just move towards Kara. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you will be invited to be part of our conversation. If you have a question or comment, 805-781-3875. You can find me after the show by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Find me on Facebook or Instagram. You can leave me a message there, and I'm happy to reply. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. Brad keeps it up to date. We have about, 12 years worth of shows that you can produce. They're ready to go.
Yeah.
And if you want to stay current, you can podcast our show like all the hip, cool people do. Just wherever it is you find your podcast, look for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Hit subscribe, leave a review so other people can find us, and that would be jolly. So we're going to take a quick break and come back and start our conversation with Kara Woodruff right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
I do wonder what a champion eats in the morning. How many times she go hungry before she won in New Orleans? Didn't start this race until after it had begun. Only started this race because I thought it would be fun. Take a paw full of honey with my breakfast, and I'ma tip my hat to the bees. Been trying to prevent fires in the forest. All this dancing smoke was once our tree. Oh. Guess it's better to push through the pain than to give up completely. I guess it's better to push through the pain. Anybody could sing. Better make sure it means something. Anybody could sing.
I love this song. Proxima Parada, our local guys.
Yeah.
Nick's singing there. Anybody can sing. Beautiful song.
And I was drawing some inspiration from it as I was listening, because as your mind wanders through the day's news, it's easy to lose track of, the message that's being delivered here in this song.
That's right. That's why I wanted to start off the show with a little uplift, because my friend Kara Woodruff is that kind of person to me. She brings that Proxima Parada happy energy to my life. So I'm going to share with you. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Kara, I'm so glad you're here.
Hi, Elizabeth. It's so fun to see you and be here.
All right. So you're going to be here with a little more of your experiential hat on.
Okay.
So as I already said, that you're a mom to two, Landy
yep.
and Harlan. We raised our girls together.
Together. We sure did.
Great time. Yeah. But now we're kind of off, both of us pursuing more of our professional trajectory.
Mm-hmm. And passion, maybe.
And passions, yes. Because yeah. we now have enough experience to see where we could best fit, maybe.
Mm-hmm. And more time and energy to focus on maybe our careers and before when we were so busy raising our kids.
Yes.
Although we did that too then.
We did both. But there is this, feeling that at this point in our life, we both kind of know what our strengths are, right?
Right.
We know what our gifts are.
We were talking about that.
Yeah.
Yes.
And where we can actually be of service to the community. Because when we talk about, there's four core values to a satisfactory life. And first is meaningful work. The second one is a deep connection of friendships. Mm-hmm. Third one is good health. But the fourth one is to be of service to others. And so part of our role as more elders in the community is to find where we can be of service. Now, you've been of service for much longer than in your elder years. So I'd like to start. Yes, I mentioned that currently you are the district director for our Senator John Laird.
I am.
You also are a member of the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary Advisory Council.
That's brand new, but yes, really excited about
Very
that.
Very excited. And longtime member of the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel.
Correct.
But before we talk about those three things, what was, you know, your college self thinking, and how did you find your way into doing this kind of environmental and political work?
I guess I've always been interested in politics and policy as a means to get things done, to make the world a little bit of a better place. And I think growing up, there were probably two things that were important to me. And I think pretty much everything I've done after that has been in aligned with that. And the first one was probably my dad. I was very close to him, and he passed away recently. But he grew up in a coal mining town in Appalachia, Kentucky. And he grew up with pretty extreme poverty. And all those things you hear about the coal mining towns are true. You don't get paid much. His father was a miner. The pay you do get is script, and you use it in the company store. There is no money, and everything they eat, they grow. It was a very desperate, I would say, lifestyle. And my dad was lucky because he escaped that, long story, but ended up, because of the goodness of other people, pursuing a career in engineering. And so I was, I guess, very appreciative of how much I had as a young person growing up in California. I had definitely an upper middle class lifestyle because of my dad having to work so hard to change his life. Mm-hmm. And I think that's always made me very passionate about trying to do my part to help people who didn't have all the privileges that I had. That's for real. And the other thing I would say is I've always loved the natural world. I spent my life growing up in canyons at the beach, and I've always loved wildlife. And so that's been a big part of who I am too, trying to find myself in a natural place and also preserve those places for people and wildlife. So went to college, went to Cal Poly. I studied business because my dad said it was the best major to pursue, but I don't think it was my passion. I did it because said it was a good idea. And I really wanted to go to law school, and I did. And after that, I had a very meandering, unstraight line of life, but I spent some years working for nonprofit conservation groups and gotten very involved in conservation projects in San Luis Obispo County. I spent 20 years as a financial planner. That's another issue, which was really rewarding. But when my youngest went off to college, I was looking for something different. And I ran into John Laird, who was running for state senate, when he was down here meeting and greeting with people when he was running for office. And I bumped into him and I said, John, I think you're great. I love you. I would love to work for you. So when you win this race, call me and let me know if you're interested. And so after he was elected, he called me and he said, were you serious? Would you like to work for me? And I said, heck yeah.
Did it surprise you?
It did. It did surprise me. It was wonderful. I think extremely highly of John Laird, and we can go into that too. But so when he started his term as state senate 5 years ago, I joined him, and he has 3 years and a couple months left in his term. And my intention is to stick with him until he terms out.
And then maybe, who knows what comes next?
I have some plans, but that's another story too.
Well, and for people who have lived for a long time might know that you were involved in the conservation of over 100,000 acres along the coast of California with the Hearst Project. Was that the first one that you worked on?
So I worked for the Nature Conservancy and then the American Land Conservancy. Okay. And with it always takes a village and a team to do conservation projects. But as a team member, I was directly involved in the conservation of the 83,000-acre Hearst Ranch, the Carrizo property known as the Chimeneas Ranch. I was involved in that project. Cambria Coast Ranch, which is 1,500 acres in Cambria, the Gaddetti Ranch, which is outside of San Luis Obispo, the Irish Hills properties, and some others. So I've been involved in a lot of conservation projects. It's been really exciting. And not only is good for the wildlife, but many of these projects enable public access so people can get out, enjoy the natural world, which is really good for the heart and the soul, and also not bad for the local economy either. So it's a great quality of life activity. Yeah. And I felt so blessed and excited to be a part of those projects.
Did you intend when you became an attorney to do nonprofit environmental work, or was that separate from your...
That was my intention. Okay. And when I graduated from law school, I applied for all these different conservation groups and nonprofits and environmental action groups, and I got zero interviews and zero job offers. Which was very depressing after a lot of work. But I did get a job where they were offering, which was a big law firm in San Francisco. And that was a job where I learned a lot, but I was pretty miserable. And so the first opportunity I had, I moved back to San Luis Obispo because, as I mentioned, I'm a Cal Poly Mustang, and worked for a small law firm, which was wonderful for a short time. And then I found a job with the Nature Conservancy, followed by the other organization. So, yeah, it was a windy road. But I think ultimately working for a nonprofit was what I was looking for, where you're really focused on doing something that feels like your good and hard work has some great outcomes.
Well, and there's a through line, which I also think is important, you know, when we're guiding young people towards their life's work or their life's goals, that you knew the things that you were connected to as a youngster. You loved the outdoors. You're always drawn to that. And you also, you know, wanted to do well for other people, having seen how your father grew up. And so you stayed with kind of that, those values. And that kind of drew you towards where you needed to be. And I wonder if we spent more time helping young people pay attention to what their values are, their core beliefs, their core sense of meaning inside. Like, what are the things that you always read? I always say, like, when you open a magazine or you open a newspaper, what are the articles you always read? And that's a great tip or a great hint as to the places you probably want to put your energy.
I totally agree. I guess the way I would put it is what sings to you.
Yes.
And I feel like in life there are so many setbacks and disappointments and the job offers you didn't get or the places you wanted to move to but couldn't figure out a way to make it work. Mm-hmm. But if you know what sings to you, if you know what you care about, just never give up. And sometimes you can't get that job you want right away. Mm-mm. Sometimes you have to do something else, build your resume, try again, accept setbacks, have some failures along the way. But if you always know what you're looking for, you never know where you might find it. And you hear people say, if you bark up enough trees, you'll eventually catch a cat. We just have to, throughout life, keep barking up trees until we find what we want, and also be prepared to make scary changes and take risks, because there are people that have a job and stick with it all their life. And if they're fulfilled, great. But if they're not, I say find a better situation, make the change, accept the stress and the challenges that come along with it. But I think the outcome is totally worth it, because you just should never give up on what's important to you.
And to be paying attention to what it is that we loved when we were young, because I think we downplay the things we loved when we were young, 5, 6. What were you doing? What kind of things were you playing with? Where did you want to hang out? We really get those clues early. And
good
also
point.
That you might not have the job that takes you there. But as I mentioned earlier, that, you know, being of service to others, finding other ways to be involved that might not be work.
Absolutely.
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest today is Kara Woodruff, District Director for Senator John Laird, local resident for over 30 years, mom of two, wife of one.
Indeed.
I'm going to let you start off. Let's talk about your work with Senator Laird and what's coming up and some things you're excited about. And then I think that'll probably move us into Diablo Canyon and the Marine Sanctuary too.
Sure.
So you start.
So working for Senator Laird is really fun and really rewarding and really challenging. And he is a state senator, so he works in Sacramento at the state capitol. And
yes.
I clarify that because a lot of people aren't sure. Sometimes people come up to me and say, oh, how do you like working in D.C.? And I say, I go to Sacramento once in a while, but never D.C.
And that's a great, maybe that's where we need to start.
Okay.
Because who are our representatives on all sides with the senator and the Congress and state senator and state congressman? I don't know if we would all know who our representatives are.
So in the United States of America, we essentially have 51 governments. We have the national government, and then every state has its own government. And in California, of course, our capital is in Sacramento. We have a governor, Governor Newsom, as you all know. And then we have the Senate side, just like the U.S. government, the Senate, and the equivalent of the House of Representatives, which is what they have on the federal side. In California, we call it the Assembly. There are 40 state senators, and they each represent about a million people. And there are 80 state assembly members, and they represent about half a million. Senator Laird, in particular, represents the 17th Senate District, which is by far the most beautiful district in the world. It includes all of Santa Cruz County, all of Monterey County, all of San Benito County. Until recently represented all of San Luis Obispo, but during redistricting, he has most of San Luis, but not all the parts of southern San Luis Obispo County. Working for a senator is really interesting, and there's almost two parts to the job. He has a staff that's based in Sacramento, and they are focused on legislation, introducing, getting bills passed. And I'm happy to report that of the 14 bills that Senator Laird authored that landed up on the governor's desk, all 14 were signed. And that's a sign of true success. And then that's half the job. The other half of the job is really focusing on the needs, the concerns, the challenges of people who live in the district, that million number of people who have a range of issues. And this is a particularly challenging time because people come to us with very sometimes trivial concerns, like I can't get a check cashed, or I showed up at the post office and it's messy and I couldn't even figure out where the desk was. We hear everything. And then there's some very scary concerns, like I have assistance with the purchase of getting food every month. And we know that some of that federal funding for food that supplements the lives of over 100,000 people in San Luis Obispo County, it's really uncertain right now. And we have people in our district who've been laid off, who maybe worked in U.S. Forest Service. You talked about the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary Advisory Council, which I was newly appointed to. We were supposed to have our first meeting last week, but it was canceled because the federal government workers are not being paid right now and are not working. So the job as a district director is to work with the other district staff, try to meet the needs the constituents bring to us. Also, sometimes we recommend legislation for the senator to sponsor. Sometimes we get involved in the possible extension of the Diablo Canyon power plant. And that's something that is very topical right now. We can go into that in more detail. But there's a range of issues and there's a lot happening on the Central Coast. And I get the great privilege of being a part of a lot of that on Senator Laird's behalf. It's wonderful.
How many district directors are there? How many work for Senator Laird?
So I'm the only district director.
Okay.
But we have a handful of people who are district representatives that work in each of the counties.
Okay. And then they all kind of report back to you, and then you report up to Senator Laird?
I would say so. Okay. What I would say about Senator Laird, he's not a particularly hierarchical, bureaucratic person.
Yeah.
And I think all of us know that we can contact him anytime. So we all work together as a team. And we have a great team, I have to say.
And then who represents us in the Assembly?
So the assembly member for this region is Assemblymember Dawn Addis. She's wonderful. She has a district director, Andrea Chmelik, wonderful. Great staff, Jen Ford. Just a really great elected official to work with and a super strong staff.
So how do you know who to go to with your concerns as a citizen, your assemblyman or your senator?
How does somebody from the public know?
Yeah, how would you know?
If you can always just Google, who is my senator? Who is my assembly member? And it's pretty easy to find. And then once you know who it is, like Senator Laird, you can just Google Senator John Laird, and you can get to his site that is set up by the California State Senate. And it will tell you what are the issues of importance, what are the bills that he's authored, how do you get in contact with the office. When there's something that comes up like a fire event. We'll post special information about that, how to get information, where can you get direction on whether you need to evacuate, what can you do to prevent any kind of damage to your home. So it's a really great resource, and that's always a good place to start.
But I guess the other part of my question is, how do I know which issues I'm having go right would be an assemblyman's issue or a senator's issue?
Because
if the post office is dirty, I don't think it's Senator Laird's issue, but would it be my assemblyman or would it be my county supervisor? Like how do, as a person, a citizen of the public, how do I know which representative to go to for which issues?
Well, first of all, most people don't know, and oftentimes they go to the wrong office,
okay, that's
but
I
that's
know.
Okay.
Okay.
Sometimes if someone comes to us with a uniquely federal issue, then we help them as we can, or we refer them to staff members for, in our case, Salud Carbajal, who's our local congressman. And so you don't have to get it right. If you have a problem, you can reach out. And there's other levels of government. So we also have county supervisors. We have five supervisors that represent the San Luis Obispo County region. We also have every city within San Luis Obispo County has a city council and a mayor. So if you have a problem, sometimes it's obvious. A post office is federal. So in some ways you think, oh, I should call my federal congressman. But if you don't get it right, you can always try, and we redirect people all the time. No big deal.
And so what are some of the key issues that Senator Laird, I don't know if I want to say ran on because he's already been in office for five years, but what are his legislative focuses, his 14 bills? What is he?
So he has a really broad focus.
Okay.
And for anybody who has met Senator Laird, he probably knows more details about complicated issues and more people in government than any other elected I've ever met. And I mean that sincerely. And part of that's because he's been in government for 40 years. He was the mayor of Santa Cruz. He served on the city council. He was an assembly member. He's now a state senator. And he served as 8 years as the California Natural Resources Agency secretary under Governor Brown. So he has so much experience. But there are some issues that really rise to the top, particularly representing the 17th Senate District. Some of those are energy. We are all grappling in this modern world with making sure we have enough energy to keep the lights on, but also doing so in a way that is sustainable. And climate change is real. We've got to make a transition away from fossil fuels, but that transition is challenging and tricky, very difficult. And so we look to other energy sources to try to solve this dilemma. And so there's battery storage, there's wind energy, solar, wind, and nuclear. And all those issues come up a lot in the 17th Senate District because, interestingly enough, there's only one nuclear power plant left in the state that's operating. That's at Diablo Canyon in San Luis County. Mm-hmm. We have some of the biggest solar arrays out in the Carrizo of any place in the state. Yeah. There's been battery storage that's been proposed in Morro Bay. We have a new battery storage facility down in South County, Caballero. We have offshore wind being proposed off the Central Coast. There's only two locations in the state of California that is being proposed, and one of them is offshore of San Luis Obispo County. So I could go on and on, but there are many, many energy issues, and they really do focus on 17th Senate District, which is why Senator Laird and me on his behalf spend an awful lot of time on energy issues.
So where are we with... because you are also a longtime member of the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel, even prior to working for Senator Laird.
Right.
Where are we with that?
So that's really interesting. We could spend the next 40 hours talking about Diablo Canyon. But to make a long story short, Diablo Canyon has two units, two reactors. They were set to close at the end this year. That did not happen. And the reason why is a handful of years ago, 22, Governor Newsom announced an intention to keep Diablo open for an extended period of time in order to prevent blackouts during those peak times during critical weather events and to just generally have overall grid stability. So in 2022, the Senate and the Assembly passed SB 846, and that allowed for the extension of Diablo Canyon from 2025 until 2030. Mm-hmm. So coincidentally, there is a big event coming up next week that's all about that.
Okay.
In order for PG&E to continue operating Jabal Canyon for 5 more years. They had a lot of things they had to do. They had to secure fuel in order to run the reactors. They had to keep employees employed and not leave to go elsewhere. And they also had to obtain a lot of permits, both federal and the state, in order to continue operating. So on the federal side, they have to get a license extension from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. That's in progress and will probably happen by early next year. On the state side, they also have a lot of requirements. One of them is they have to get a coastal development permit and consistency determination under federal law from the Coastal Commission. And that item is finally on the Coastal Commission agendas. It's on their agenda a week from Thursday. And the whole point of the meeting is to determine whether the Coastal Commission shall give PG&E the permits it needs to continue operating. And under the rules that guide the Coastal Commission, they are supposed to identify what are the environmental impacts of extending Diablo and what can we do to mitigate for them. So they prepared a staff report which says that if you want to get our permit to continue operating Diablo, you've got to do X, Y, and Z to mitigate for the impacts associated primarily with the intake and discharge of water, which injures, kills a lot of marine organisms. Senator Laird was very involved in that because he took a look at the staff report and disagrees wholeheartedly with its conclusions. And we can talk more about that. But he has since written a letter to the Coastal Commission. And it is going to be an interesting meeting next week because it's not going to be a meeting, I think, where people just go in and vote for the staff report. There's going to be a debate.
Which I'm sure you enjoy. If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Kara Woodruff, District Director for Senator John Laird and one of my dearest friends. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. We're going to take a quick break and come back. We'll open up our phone lines at 805-781-3875 if you have a question for my guest right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
I need a sign. Let me know you're here. All of these lines are being crossed over the atmosphere. I need to know that things are gonna look up. 'Cause I feel us drowning in a sea spilled from a cup. And there is no place safe and no safe place to put my head. When you can feel the world shake.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist with my guest today, Kara Woodruff. And we're kind of talking about the state of affairs in California and also Kara's involvement in many aspects of environmental protection and conservation. And you seem to have found this perfect position with Senator Laird, who is clearly environmentally focused as well.
Yes.
So when you talked about earlier, find the thing that sings to you, I think you and Senator Laird are in harmony.
I'm singing.
And so you start talking about what's going to be coming up with this new meeting with the Diablo Canyon decommissioning panel and the decision that the California
Coastal Commission
needs to make.
Right.
And that Senator Laird has
chimed in
and does not agree with the reports. And I'm curious, do our U.S. senators, Schiff and Padilla, I think, would they have any interest in this issue as well, since it seems that energy is kind of a national conversation?
Mm-hmm. I think they are both interested, but I don't think they've been intimately involved, because on the federal side, the really key issue is the permit, the licensing that's issued by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. That's an agency. And the NRC issues those licenses that determine whether a nuclear power plant can continue. And PG&E has applied for a 20-year license renewal for Diablo Canyon, although the state has only offered and authorized a 5-year extension. So there's a little bit of an inconsistency there.
Right. What happens then?
So PG&E needs both. They need the license renewal by the NRC, a federal process. And as I said, it's expected they'll get that early 2026. But they also need state authority. And under SB 846, the bill we talked about before, they have authorization to operate until 2030. But without a new piece of legislation that goes through the legislative process and is signed by the governor in the future, the plant will close in 2030 unless the state provides an additional extension down the road.
And what do you anticipate, or what does Senator Laird anticipate will happen, since he's, you know, kind of called for a pause or has not agreed with the initial report?
His position is that Diablo Canyon is extending under SB 846 from 2025 to 2030. What he takes issue with is what PG&E will be required to do to mitigate for the impacts of operating Diablo for 5 years. And what he's calling for, and this is really consistent with the wording of the staff report and all these community efforts, and he's calling for mitigation that looks like this: conservation easement over all of North Ranch, which is a part of the Diablo Canyon lands, all of South Ranch, protection of Wild Cherry Canyon, a whole host of public trails, and an endowment that would allow those trails to be built. And just to give a little bit of background, many years ago, this community expressed an interest in protecting the so-called Diablo Canyon lands. Those are the 12,000 acres that surround Diablo Canyon Power Plant. This was first expressed in something called the Dream Initiative. It was a ballot measure that was on the ballot for all county residents in the year 2000. And the question was, do you think we should protect these lands when Diablo Power Plant closes? And the answer was overwhelmingly yes. Almost 75% of people voted yes on that. Since that time, there have been many, many other processes, and they've all come to the same conclusion that an operating Diablo Canyon, which provides a lot of benefits to locals, employees, tax revenues, et cetera, we should also make sure that those lands are protected and that they're protected for the benefit of wildlife, for scenic values, for protection of the cultural values, which are significant, and also to allow for public access. This Coastal Commission hearing is the opportunity to see that vision finally come to fruition. Mm-hmm. And the impacts of Diablo that will happen during these 5 years are so extensive that they more than justify the mitigation that Senator Laird is calling for. It's consistent with state and federal law. So that's really the interesting debate next week.
Is that open to the public?
Yes. Yes.
Would people Zoom in or come to the meeting?
The meeting's in Sacramento. They can attend. They can also Zoom. They can provide written comments. They can participate in a public comment during the hearing. If they want to know more about it, they could go to DiabloCanyonLands.org, and there's a tab that says Action Alert, and it provides the background for this upcoming meeting. That website also has all the background you need to know what are these lands and why are they important and how can we protect them and what are the steps to ensure this vision for the community and how do we get to the point of seeing this come to fruition finally.
Would the mitigation for, if it were approved, not begin until after Diablo Canyon was closed, or would the trails and the open space be accessible prior to that?
They could and should be, in many cases, accessible prior to that. Mm-hmm. So the 12,000-acre Diablo Canyon lands are really broken down into three pieces. There's North Ranch, which is north of the plant. There's South Ranch, which is, guess what, south of the plant. Mm-hmm. And then to the east of that is Wild Cherry Canyon. I don't know if Diablo can operate with a large presence of people on South Ranch where they're trying to get employees and eventually decommissioning activities in and out there. But there already is some public access to the Diablo Canyon lands now, and I'll tell you about that. But there could be a lot more without any interference with the plant's operation. So, for example, have you heard of the Point Bouchon Trail?
Yes.
Yeah. So really popular trail. You get there by going through Montana de Oro. Mm-hmm. That is publicly available, and that's on North Ranch. That's on the Diablo Canyon lands. There's another trail that people love, the Pecho Coast Trail, which you access from the south, kind of by Port San Luis.
Mm-hmm. Is that not to the lighthouse? That's a different trail.
That's part of it. Okay. So the Pecho Coast Trail leads you to the lighthouse. And you can even go on a longer trail beyond that. And those are trails that are available for the public's use now. But what we're hoping for is not just those trails, but more trails. Trails that would extend the entire length of the 12,000 acres, mm-hmm. And also protection of the land. So right now they're owned by PG&E. We don't see efforts to fragment, develop those lands because they're owned by PG&E. But eventually we want to make sure that those lands are saved as open space. And that's what that mitigation would require. That yes, PG&E, we're going to give you the permits to extend operations, but the price tag of that is that because of all those new impacts, you have to provide increased public access, and ensure that those lands are never developed.
My guest today is Kara Woodruff, District Director for Senator John Laird. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist, and if you have a question or comment for my guest, our number is 805-781-3875. So what about Wild Cherry Canyon? Because my memory, if my memory serves, there's been a lot of controversy yeah. about if that's going to be developed for housing
right.
or become open space. Where is that currently?
This is a really complicated story.
I know.
And I started working on Wild Cherry Canyon issues in 1999.
So I remember driving up and seeing the land with
yes,
you.
Yes, I've toured you around there. Mm-hmm. This is a really neat piece of land. It's wonderful. It has incredible views over San Luis Bay. It has really special and unique cultural resources that need to be protected. There have been efforts to develop the property that have been not successful. There have been many efforts to conserve the property for one reason or another. They weren't successful. And then about, I don't know, 4 or so years ago, litigation started. Okay. And the litigation is between a subsidiary of PG&E called Eureka Energy and HomeFed, which is a developer. So HomeFed owns long-term leases that give them all the rights to do whatever they want with the property. And they're the ones who had proposed development in the past. The underlying fee title, as they call it, is owned by PG&E. Well, at one point, owned by Eureka Energy, a subsidiary. At one point, Eureka and PG&E realized that those leases held by HomeFed may not be valid. To make a long story short, that's been caught up in litigation for years now. Mm-hmm. And I think just as a couple years ago, the Court of Appeals has determined that those leases are valid. So in order to protect Wild Cherry Canyon, you'd have to do two things. You'd have to buy the leases from HomeFed. You'd have to buy the underlying fee title from Eureka Energy. You would meld the two together, and then it could be owned by maybe state parks or a nonprofit conservation group and make it open to the public. And this is very much the goal. And myself and many others are working towards that. But, you know, I don't know that we'll see a lot of advancement on that property until the litigation is finally resolved, because Eureka Energy still can't appeal the Court of Appeals decision. We'll see.
What's the best case scenario for the power plant and for the future of energy? Because I'd imagine that Senator Laird has feelings about how to continue providing right, consistent energy to the state. So what's the best case scenario?
So this is a really controversial issue.
I know.
And I think the community is pretty divided. There are those who believe that Diablo Canyon should remain open indefinitely, certainly over the next 20 years. There are those who are very opposed to Diablo Canyon or concerned about certain aspects of it, like the long-term storage of spent nuclear fuel, which has nowhere to go. And also the fact that there are seismic conditions that concern people underlying the power plant. But the question of whether it should operate was framed pretty narrowly under SB 846, which was the legislation that allowed it to be extended.
Right, the most
current. And the question was, do we really need Diablo Canyon's power for grid stability, even during extreme weather events during peak times, which is like 4 to 6 or 7 p.m.? So the California Energy Commission has spoken on this issue very recently. In fact, every year they come out with a report that talks about grid stability. Is this necessary? Is that necessary? In this last fall, in August, at a hearing of the Senate Energy Committee, and last month at the Diablo Canyon Decommission Engagement Panel, two separate representatives from the California Energy Commission suggested that, in fact, Diablo Canyon's power is not necessary beyond 2030 because we have all these renewables that are coming online. This is pretty shocking that they would say that in public.
It's not why.
Because there's all this talk about, oh, the demand for energy is just skyrocketing and AI, and we need all these databases and people are needing more electricity because they're buying more electric vehicles. Mm-hmm. And with weather and climate changes, people are using their AC longer during hotter periods, or maybe they're going to be using their heater during the winter. So there are a lot of factors, a lot of constraints that suggest our demand, our thirst for energy continue to go up very rapidly. But when the California Energy Commission and all the experts they have look at the question with an unbiased eye and they try to determine what is really necessary and they consider all those factors I just suggested, they're telling us that Diablo Canyon is probably not necessary. And part of that is just the sheer size. So people have this impression that Diablo Canyon, it provides some 8.5-9% of the state's energy. It does, but it doesn't necessarily have to. Over the last 5 years, there have been 25 gigawatts of new energy in the form of renewables that have been brought to the grid. Compare that to Diablo Canyon. It's 2.2 gigawatts. So 25 was just brought on the grid in the last 5 years. More is coming. Diablo represents 2.2. So from a pure number perspective, you can see that Diablo is not as essential as we are led to believe. Now, it's more complicated than that because not all energy runs all the time, and solar energy is not much good to you when the lights go off, when the sun
when the fog comes in.
But that's where battery storage comes in. It can hold the energy that's generated by solar and then offer it to the grid when it's most needed. So that'll be the central question, because SB 846 was framed on the need for Diablo. And the assumption was if we didn't need it, we could close it. In fact, the legislation provides that if you find out before 2030 you don't need it, you can close it. Well, it looks like they're saying now we're going to be good. We're going to need it between now and 2030, but we probably don't need it after that. So does that mean Diablo should close? Some say yes, some say no. But the underlying motivation to extend it 5 years was based on the need, which the California Energy Commission is saying probably doesn't exist after 2030.
Mm. So I have family in Moss Landing that were heavily affected by the fire at the battery storage plant. So how do we mitigate those concerns if that's
the future?
That's a big
deal. Right. We probably can't get to our clean energy goals in 2045 without battery storage. And just as a little backup, we have a state policy, it's law, that says by 2045, we're going to be 100% on renewables, no more fossil fuels to energize our grid. But battery storage is an absolutely essential element. We really can't get there without it. So what do you do? Because Moss Landing was terrifying. That's in Senator Laird's district. And rightfully so, the people that live there were terrified about what happened. It was really scary. And we all saw the videos. Those flames were high. And we know that the metals went somewhere. And the smoke, great concern. Well, in response to that, Senator Laird just got signed by the governor SB 340, which calls for a heightened level of security and safety standards. In fact, when you create an when you construct a new battery storage facility, you have to have the local fire department review it and sign off on it. It provides that some of the structures that were responsible for the big fire in Moss Landing are no longer available, could no longer be employed by those who are constructing battery
because
storage.
Because of the new regulations.
Right, right. We know now you don't want to put batteries in a building. That's a bad idea. You want to construct a facility where you have individual units, battery packs, and when one burns up, it just burns itself up and doesn't spread. So unfortunately, battery is a very quickly moving technology. And when we first started building it, a decade or more ago, we didn't know then what we know now. So new construction is going to be a lot better, a lot safer. These new safety standards will impact some of the older systems. But it's a concern, and we probably have to think about where we site battery storage facilities. Some places might be well-suited. Out in the California Valley, where there's no people living around, might be a good solution. There's problems with that too, but I think we have to be careful and thoughtful, require a lot of those who sponsor those projects. But at the end of the day, we just need battery storage. It's a huge part of the solution.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to my guest, Kara Woodruff, who is here in her role as district director for Senator John Laird, but also has been very active in environmental projects for well over 25 years.
Yeah.
I mean, the statistic alone, my friend, that you've been working on projects that have protected over 100,000 acres along the California coast, if you could rest your hat on that, that would be an incredible thing to look back on your life and career to have accomplished. I'm so proud of you. But, you know, you never stop moving forward, which I also admire. So your work with Senator Laird is part of it, but now you've been named as a member of the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary Advisory Council. What does that entail? And tell me why we're excited about the existence of the Heritage National Marine Sanctuary. And does it align with our future energy goals?
What great questions.
Thank you.
And thank you for your nice comments, Elizabeth. I want to interview you on the radio next time, and I get to bring out your cool, all the many things you've done in your life. So I'm really excited to be a part of the Sanctuary Advisory Council. By way of background, a number of years ago, a group of people, including representatives of the Northern Chumash Tribal Council and the Sierra Club and some others, had this great idea to seek a designation of the coastal waters off San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara County as a National Marine Sanctuary. And once you have that designation, cool things happen. So once you have a marine sanctuary, you can't do offshore oil drilling anymore. There's other things you cannot do. Fishing is not regulated, but it limits the kind of activities that can occur in a sanctuary. And if you want to do an activity, you have to get special permission from the federal government to do so. So it really protects the fisheries, it protects the scenic views, it reduces some of the industrialization of the coast that we can anticipate in the future. So it's really great. If your goal is to preserve marine life, it's a wonderful designation to have.
Does Monterey County,
yes,
already, Santa Cruz already have,
yes,
that?
Yes. So there are different marine sanctuaries throughout the United States. Some are in Hawaii, some off the West Coast, some of the East Coast. In this region, so there's a Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. Mm-hmm. There are more sanctuaries to the north of that. There's a Channel Island Sanctuary that's off Santa Barbara County, which is also protected. And then between, we had this big gap. So mm-hmm. the goal of the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary, which was the first tribally suggested sanctuary, is to kind of close the gap between those two sanctuaries. Time went by, more enthusiasm was developed, 100,000 people wrote letters of support for the designation of the sanctuary. It's an incredible effort. Mm-hmm. Eventually, the sanctuary was designated, but with some changes to reflect offshore wind. So it originally was going to be a sanctuary that would stretch all the way from the existing Channel Island Sanctuary all the way up to Monterey Bay. But there was a lot of pushback, both from the offshore wind industry and, frankly, from the federal administration at that time, that if a sanctuary were in place, that might undermine the ability for offshore wind to be developed. And at that point, offshore wind leases had already been sold to three leaseholders. Mm-hmm. And so the compromise was, we're going to designate this area. It's about 4,000 square miles, so it's a very large, significant sanctuary in and of itself. But we're going to do that in this first stage. And the second step is, if offshore wind continues to be developed, notwithstanding current obstacles by the new administration, those structures would be developed, those transmission lines would be placed, and then after that, they would overlay a new sanctuary on top of it. Okay. So it wouldn't stop offshore wind from going in, but it would prevent other activities in the future that could undermine marine resources, et cetera. So I think that's a very cool outcome, but definitely it was affected by offshore wind and this quest for renewable energy sources. Mm-hmm. The designation was finally carried out in December of 2025, and I would say just in the nick of time, because I doubt that the new administration would have supported it. In fact, the new administration has expressed strong interest in developing the California coastline for offshore oil, which doesn't have a lot of support locally for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, the new Chumash Sanctuary is official. It's a real thing. It's very exciting because it's not only about preventing certain incompatible uses, but it also brings with it so many exciting things, like really cool research projects and people who come here and do their dissertations, and really amazing marine discoveries can be found. Like in the Monterey Bay Sanctuary, because it's a sanctuary, because it's a protected area, because it's attracted all this interest by the scientific community, they actually discovered maybe the world's largest octopus garden. The world's largest. Wow. We didn't even know existed. But in the course of the sanctuary and all the excitement that it brought, people went down there, explored to great depths. And it turns out there's a huge cultivation of octopus babies on the floor of this very deep trench. And if you do a Google search, you'll find it. The pictures are amazing. So we don't even know what wonders await us. But the resources that a sanctuary can bring are pretty phenomenal. And I think everybody would say that the Monterey Bay Sanctuary ended up being more successful beyond anyone's wildest dreams. And it also attracts tourism, and it works so well with the Monterey Bay Aquarium. So there's, I think, a lot of really exciting things to come with the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary. So last year they opened up applications. I applied. I was very lucky to be selected. And it's a pretty big sanctuary board. I think there's about 20 of us.
Wow.
And my particular spot is San Luis Obispo County at large. There's also a Santa Barbara County at large member, and there's tribal representatives, and there's academic representatives, and there's fishing interests, and there are science people. There are people that specialize in education and outdoor recreation. So they have like a seat for all the different ways that people enjoy and explore the marine environment and the ocean. And everybody has a say, I guess, as you would say. And my personal goal is to see if we can help close that gap that we lost when the marine sanctuary was scaled back to accommodate for a future offshore wind. So my goal is, as in this role, I'd really like to close that gap and have complete sanctuary protection from Monterey all the way down to Santa Barbara.
Beautiful vision. Thank you, my friend, for coming in to be my guest today. Kara Woodruff is the district director for Senator John Laird. If you have questions for your senator, the website for Senator Laird is...
You know, I don't know the website, but just Google Senator John Laird.
There you
You'll
go.
Find it.
That is the answer for all things. But there's contacts forms that you can send in,
yeah,
or an email to contact people. And they're very clearly responsive to what's going on. So thank you for coming in and sharing the updates. And also, if people want to get involved with the Diablo Canyon meeting that's coming up, they go to Diablo Lands.
DiabloCanyonLands.org. And then look for the tab that says Action Alert.
Thank you, Kara.
Thank you.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com for more information, or send me a message through Facebook or Instagram. Listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. Podcast our show, share it with your friends so we can grow our community. And I'll see you next Tuesday at 2 right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Now I've been happy lately, thinking about the good things to come. And I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world at one. And I believe it could be someday it's going to come. 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country, come take me home again. Smiling lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, peace train sound.